Good morning. Is my mic not working? Good morning. Expect a good morning back. Okay, thanks. My name is Jabari Yassim. I'm director of the graduate program Creative Writing at Emerson College. I see some Emersonians in the audience here and there. It's my pleasure to welcome you to my first time. Wow, just now occurred to me how sexy that title is. Writers and their double entendres. Will it never end? So this panel will showcase a trio of first-time novelists, and we have so much to absorb and enjoy and discuss, and very little time in which to do it. So this will be our format. I'm going to introduce all three writers at the same time. Then each will read an excerpt from their novel. Afterward, I'll toss a question their way to get the discussion started. And then we'll open it up to the audience, because I'm sure you have a lot of thoughts that you will want to share. And we'll proceed from there. I do ask that when you do pose a question, that you do so at the microphones, which will enable our recording of the session. And also, I want to tell you that after our discussion, the authors will be available to sign their books right outside. So nearest me is Louie Cronin. She's a writer and member of PRI's The World team. Her career in public radio has included producing The Connection and the long-running show Car Talk. She's a graduate of Boston University's creative writing program. She has published in the Princeton Arts Review, the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and Newsday, and has been a finalist for Glimmer Train and New Millennium Writing Awards. Her novel, Everyone Loves You Back, is a coming of middle age story. I like that. That Margot Livesey has called wonderfully witty and inventive. And in our center is Louise Miller. She's been a baker for over 20 years and currently lives and works in Boston as the pastry chef of the Union Club. She received a 2012 scholarship to attend Grub Street's Novel Incubator Program, which I'm hoping we'll be able to touch on when we get to the discussion. It's a year-long workshop for novelists. Library Journal calls her debut novel, The City Baker's Guide to Country Living, a rich and warm romance. And next we have Hirsch Sawney. He's a writer and novelist. His articles and essays have appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times Book Review, The Guardian, The Indian Express, Financial Times, and Outlook. He's also the editor of Delhi Noir, a critically acclaimed anthology of original fiction. And his debut novel, South Haven, is a 2016 Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick. Please join me in welcoming them all. And Louie, I hope you can get us started by reading
all
from
right.
her,
okay.
from your novel first. Thanks.
Okay.
You want to set it up for us a little bit?
Okay, yes. So I have to bring this down. I'll be the shortest here, I'm sure. So this novel is set in Cambridge, and it's also set at a local radio station in the Boston area. And it's actually going to be published next Friday. So this is a huge day for me. It's hugely exciting. This is really a launch for me. Thank you. I'm going to start out reading from just the very beginning. I always find it's hard to follow if you're in the middle and you wonder if you missed something. So you'll know you didn't miss anything. If you're confused, it's because the first page is confusing. Okay, chapter one. Bob Boland is surrounded. Yuppies everywhere. Goddamn professional women with their blunt cuts and power suits. They're wimpy men, pale-faced with narrow-shouldered, their PhDs, MDs, and JDs on proud display in their book-lined studies. The neighborhood has always been full of snobs. Half of it belongs to Harvard, the other half to Harvard professors, grads, and wannabes, the type who donate buildings and gymnasiums, who endow symphony chairs in perpetuity. But there used to be room for the little people, who deliver the mail, plow the driveways, clean the teeth, fix the burners. Now the new rich are crowding them out, throwing around so much money that the neighborhood is barely recognizable, Slate roofs, copper drains, specimen trees, heated driveways, nothing is too good for them. If there's a beautiful front yard, they put up a fence. If there's a fence, they tear it down and put in a hedge. Blacktop becomes lawn, lawn becomes ground cover becomes brick. And God forbid the house should peel. Bingo, an army of painters descends, airlifted from the latest third world country in collapse, sanding, scraping, hanging like bats under the eaves, risking their lives to try out matching trim colors. Bob never thought he'd be singing the praises of the horse faces, stingy old bastards with their patched tweed jackets and homely gray-haired wives, wearing the same frayed shirts and resoled shoes year in and year out, living in their gloomy mansions, driving their 10-year-old Mercedes, riding their three-speed Raleighs with the cracked leather seats and rusty wire baskets, scarves wrapped around their necks like they were in merry old England, the motherland, the well from which their bottomless coldness must have sprung. But now he feels something approaching affection for them, for mannish old Priscilla Sutton, lurching down the street in her Wellingtons and worn flannel shirt, her white hair escaping from a headband. Even she looks a little uncomfortable now, unsure where she belongs in this new world of conspicuous consumption. At 11:30 at night, when everyone else in the neighborhood is getting ready for bed, clicking off the TV after an IQ-lowering dose of local news, turning down the covers, slipping between the 600 thread count sheets, curling up with a New Yorker, a mystery, a spiritual how-to, Bob is heading to WJZY. His shift starts at midnight, but he likes to get to the station a few minutes early, pull some CDs, set up the breaks, clean up the studio after that pig, BJ, who will watch him clean, never once getting up from his chair. BJ is so lazy, he will roll to get another CD, to program the computer, to read the log. He has mastered the soundboard push-off. He's the gold medalist of the chairbound. Every night, the trash can overflows with fast food wrappers, crushed coffee cups, old newspapers, spent ketchup packets. And BJ has the body to show for it. He has grown into his chair. His hips and ass seep girlishly over the sides. Like nearly everyone in radio, BJ has a good voice, deep and round, with a butterscotch finish. You picture James Earl Jones, maybe Gregory Peck in To Kill a Mockingbird, but what you get is a pale, fat, 35 going on 55 white guy who is obsessed with jazz. Bob is obsessed with jazz too, but he doesn't look the part. He still has the broad shoulders and muscled upper body of the athlete he was supposed to be. His sports career foundered his freshman year at UMass when he discovered jazz and pot. The coach threw him off the team. His father stopped talking to him. His mother slipped him tuition money, and he graduated with an individually crafted degree in altered states of consciousness and the evolution of bebop. Find a job with that. Bob always gets to the station before Riff, who is out in the parking lot smoking a joint. Now that it is forbidden to smoke in the studio, Riff makes do with a before-show toke and a pick-me-up in the men's room during breaks. Back when Bob started in radio, everybody smoked, cigarettes and marijuana, ashtray right next to the microphone, helped your voice get that nice gravelly touch, gave men the balls they might lack, and women the balls they almost certainly did. Riff is another little white guy pretending to be black, but at least he was one of the first. He's been around forever, snuck into clubs to see Miles and Coltrane when he was a teen. He has a very low-maintenance approach to his appearance, shaves his head once a year, ignores it for the rest. He wears nothing but jumpsuits, which he designs, and his third, younger wife dutifully sews. His only regular upkeep is his pointy little goatee, a must for white guys pretending to be black. After 20 years in radio, Bob could write a treatise about white guys pretending to be black. Most of these black-white guys ended up with drug problems, the only surefire way to shed their middle-class privilege. But Bob respects Riff. Back when he decided to become a black man, it wasn't the thing to do. And Riff still likes white people. He and Bob started working together when WJZY was mostly jazz. Now it's mostly news. They have been together for 13 years, longer than any of Riff's marriages, longer by far than any of Bob's relationships. Occasionally, they socialize on the weekends, getting together after midnight. Riff's wife, Sue, cooks dinner, and they drink and talk until dawn. Riff always manages to find a woman who will cater to his schedule, breakfast at 4 p.m., lunch at 11 p.m. Sue is up when he rolls in. Maybe you were a little hard on that guy who didn't know who Johnny Hodges was. You should have let the old lady finish. Riff does a kind of hybrid jazz talk show. When he feels like it, he plays music. When he gets bored, he takes calls from the audience. Old people, insomniacs, sick people, shift workers, drug addicts, musicians, they're the ones who are up all night, roaming their houses, spinning the radio dial. They talk about music, sleep, God, food, sex. Bob will cue up a CD, Pharoah Sanders, Ron Carter, and sneak it in under the conversation. Some nights, Riff awakes with a song or artist under his skin, and they play CDs all night, Riff's head bopping, Bob's foot tapping out the beat. He used to get stoned with Riff. It made a fairly easy job into a challenge. The control room board turned into a cockpit, the on-air light, a beacon, the music, a message from the other side. But now pot makes him paranoid. He starts reconsidering everything. Why do men wear pants? What if his last relationship was his last relationship? What if there were no heaven and this life mattered? Now Riff smokes alone and Bob relies on the roiling chemicals his own brain makes to keep up. This fall has been hell for Bob. He can't seem to sleep. The neighborhood comes back to life in the fall after the relative quiet of the summer. Students return to their dorms, scientists to their labs, the goddamn squirrels start fighting, designer dogs barking, school kids singing and laughing. And worse, the renovations begin anew. Contractors, plumbers, roofers, landscapers arrive in a convoy of earth movers and pickup trucks. Bob prefers the winter, the days as tight and silent as the night, the ground frozen, the air forbidding, doors and windows shuttered against the cold. Although snow is a mixed bag for the daytime sleeper. At first, it muffles everything, swaddles you in a lovely white cocoon. But then the snowblowers start and plows crash onto the asphalt and roaming bands of kids ring your bell and ask if you want them to shovel. Snow is almost worse than fall. Bob has tried sleeping pills, earplugs, a mouth guard, room darkeners, a white noise machine, a fan, an air conditioner, a contoured neck pillow, melatonin, kava kava, St. John's wort, acupuncture, vodka, beer, wine, warm milk, and chamomile tea. Nothing works. He has asked the neighbors to keep their workers quiet. He has pleaded with the workers to have pity on a fellow working man. He has stayed up whole days to make himself tired, but something new is happening. 13 years on the night shift, and he can no longer sleep. Riff glides into the control room a few minutes before air. "My man," he says, "how are things? You sleep?" Bob shakes his head. "No, today the city got into the act. They're re-bricking the sidewalks. Do you have any idea how loud a brick cutter is?" Riff shrugs. "That's a drag, man." "Who the fuck wanted new bricks anyway? Some stupid historical commission, I'm sure." "Did I tell you? This woman rang my bell the other day at 11 a.m. complaining that my trim color was not historically correct. 11 in the morning should be against the law. I think it is against the law." And she had the nerve to give me the name of some historically correct painter who will come over and do some Founding Fathers juju on the paint scheme. Probably cost a fortune. Riff is flipping through the CDs, pulling out Billie Holiday, Carmen McRae, Betty Carter. "You should sell that place, Bobby," he says. "Move out with me and the masses. Relax. That neighborhood is taking years off your life, man. And between you and me, you haven't got that many left. I was there first. Why should I have to move? Because there's one of you and lots of them and plenty more where they came from. Sell that place. You could buy a cool pad. Doesn't have to be out in the boonies with me. Could be in the city. Black people wouldn't give you all that shit." Thank you.
Hello. So my debut novel is The City Baker's Guide to Country Living. It's about a pastry chef who you'll soon hear, I'm going to read the opening, after a small incident at work, flees to northern Vermont, where her best friend lives, and she gets kind of suckered into taking a job at a small country inn, where she finds herself embroiled in a very competitive world of county fair baking contests. So, I'm going to read you the very beginning. The night I lit the Emerson Club on fire had been perfect for making meringue. I had been worrying about the humidity all week, but that night, dry, cool air drifted in through an open window. It was the 150th anniversary of the club, and Jameson Whitaker, the club's president, had requested pistachio-baked Alaska for the occasion. Since he asked while he was still lying on top of me, under the Italian linen sheets of bedroom 8, I agreed to it, even though I was fairly certain that baked Alaska would not be on the menu in 1873. But Jamie was a sucker for a spectacle, and his favorite thing on earth was pistachio ice cream, which his wife wouldn't let him eat at home. I added sugar to the egg whites a spoonful at a time. As they whipped up into a glossy cloud of white, I leaned a soft hip against my butcher block work table and surveyed the kitchen. Now, I've wielded my rolling pin in trendy city restaurants, macrobiotic catering companies, and hotels both grand and not so grand. You would think a Boston Brahmin club like the Emerson, with its dim lights, starch linens, and brass-studded leather chairs, would have a deluxe kitchen. But no matter what the dining room, or what we in the business call the front of the house, looks like, even if we're talking duct tape, naugahyde benches, hugging tin rim Formica tables, the back of the house, the kitchen, is always the same. Tables, bowls, freezer, all gleaming in a cold gray, whisks and spoons hanging in orderly rows, a mixer with the hook of my arm bent to beat bread dough. It's comforting. No matter how many times I change jobs, I could always count on the kitchen. The order, the predictability, everything familiar and in its place. I was swirling the last slope of meringue across the layers of ice cream and cake when I heard the champagne corks pop in the neighboring Jefferson room. Glenn, the GM, sprinted into the kitchen. "Almost ready, chef?" I held out my sticky fingers. "Hand me that blowtorch." The blue flame swept across the meringue, leaving a burnt trail of sugar in its wake. A swell of baritone voices thundered through the swinging door, pounding the Emerson Club anthem into the kitchen. "That's our cue," Glenn said. I ran my fingers through my freshly dyed curls. I had gone with purple this week. Manic panic electric amethyst, to be exact. Not historically accurate for a chef in the 19th century, but it's not like I was a guest. With my thumb across the lip of the bottle, I doused the confection with 150 proof rum and hoisted up the tray. "Light me on fire." Glenn lit a match and carefully set the flame to the pool of rum and the hollowed out eggshell tucked into the top. In a flash, the flames caught hold and spread across the waves of meringue. Glenn raced in front of me, holding open the doors. I stepped into the room to the last notes of the anthem, The crowd burst into applause. The tray must have weighed 40 pounds. Silver is heavy, and they don't call it pound cake for nothing. Never mind the 10 gallons of pistachio ice cream. But I stretched my mouth wide into a smile and walked about the room, squeezing between the closely set tables and standing with the members as they snapped pictures. The flames were dying down, but not quite out. Jamie stood at the back of the room by the floor-length windows, his arm wrapped tightly around his wife's waist. Their children were by their side, miniatures of their parents, one in a dark suit, the other in a crinoline dress. A light sweat broke out across my brow. How strange that the flames were getting smaller, but I was growing hotter by the second. I elbowed my way through, my biceps straining as I carried the tray above my head, trying to avoid catching anyone's gown on fire. The club treasurer put his arm around my waist, his palm resting lower on my hip than was respectable. "One for the newsletter," he said. My smile widened. I tightened my grip on the tray. Jamie looked over at me then, his eyes vacant, skimming over and then past me. He whispered in his wife's ear. She laughed, glancing in my direction. It was the last thing I saw before the tray slipped from my fingers and hit the floor. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Good morning. Thank you all for being here so early. I'm still contemplating the answer to the question, why do men wear pants? I just don't know. I think the person who brought room service to my room in the hotel this morning was wondering the same question. I have a debut novel that I'm going to read to you from. It's called South Haven. I'm going to read from like the third chapter in the book. All you need to know here is that this is a story of a family in a fictional southern New England town called New Haven, which is a suburb of New Haven. There is no South Haven in reality. We have a East Haven down there, a North Haven, a West Haven, but South Haven would geographically be in the Long Island Sound. What you need to know is that the matriarch of this family has died within the first couple of pages of the book. And the novel basically traces the way in which this family deals with this loss. One of the things, the family happens to be from India, and I don't know if that's vital information or not. Maybe it's totally integral to the story, and then again, they're just another family. So I'm just going to start reading. Oh, one other thing. I never mention this to people, but there's going to be a line about owls. And, you know, in North America, owls signify wisdom, right? And that's not a universally held concept. And in certain cultures, owls are emblematic of kind of foolishness or stupidity. Nothing is universal in terms of knowledge in this world. Anyhow, there's a line about it. You'll hear it, and now it'll make more sense than it ever has in any other reading I've done. As they drove to Deer Run Elementary School on that chilly February evening, a light snow wetted the windshield of their rust-colored car. His stomach gurgled with dread, which mounted as they approached the town center. Soon they were passing the Carter family horse farm, which was adjacent to South Haven's public library. Over the past few months, Mohanlal occasionally picked him up from school, and they would get donuts and eat them in the library parking lot. They parked as close to the horses as possible, and Siddharth got out of the car and laced his fingers through the chain link fence. One of the ponies, which had a blonde mane, sometimes came over and licked his fingers, and they started referring to it as Buddy. Whenever they visited Buddy, Mohanlal remained in the car, sipping coffee from a styrofoam cup and listening to reports about the aftermath of the Gulf War. Siddharth stood outside alone, inhaling the musky air, staring at the desolate fields and graceful horses. He occasionally looked over his shoulder to check on his father, who responded by blowing him a kiss, or just smiling. Siddharth felt good in those moments. He hadn't said a word about them to anyone, not to Arjun, nor to Ms. Farber, his school psychologist. He hadn't even said anything to his only friend at Deer Run, Sharon Nagorski. It was thanks to Arjun that he had enrolled in Deer Run Elementary back in September. Arjun had said he needed an after-school program now that they were a single-parent family, and Deer Run was the only South Haven school that had one. That term, single-parent family, made him feel like punching a wall. It was a term that should have applied to the people on television, not to real people who he knew and loved. At first, Molnar was dismissive of Arjun, but he later said that Arjun had a point and instructed him to handle all of the arrangements. Siddharth looked on as his brother pretended to be their father and phoned the principal of Robert Treat Elementary, where he had attended first through fourth grades. Once all the arrangements were finalized, Molnar told Arjun that he was proud of him for sorting everything out. He said that one day Arjun would make a good father. "Yeah, thanks," said Arjun. "One day you might make one too." Siddharth said, "Take it easy, Arjun." He was trying to be nice. The rest of the summer, Siddharth had dreaded the prospect of beginning at a new school, but once the year actually started, he saw that transferring definitely had an upside. At Deer Run, he was no longer the little brother of the great Arjun Arora, straight-A student and flag bearer. At Deer Run, he was no longer the kid with the dead mom. The problem was that at his new school, he was the new kid, a nobody who people avoided. At his new school, he only had one friend, Sharon Nagorski. The other kids called Sharon a loser. Luca Parati and Eddie Benson called her Sharon, the friendless wonder. Molnar pulled into Deer Run 5 minutes before the PTA meeting was supposed to start, parking beside the derelict tennis courts. For Siddharth, being at school for the second time in one day was a prison sentence. But accompanying his father had still seemed like the best option. Arjun was putting the school newspaper to bed, and Siddharth wasn't in the mood to be alone. More importantly, going with his father meant he could prevent him from doing something stupid. As they navigated the slushy asphalt, he clutched his father's woolen overcoat. That way, if Molnar slipped, Siddharth could break his fall. When they reached the school's entrance, they dried their winter boots on a large red mat inscribed with the word "Owls." Owls were the Deer Run mascot. Molnar muttered, "Owls? This is a place of learning, and owls are the stupidest of birds." Siddharth rolled his eyes. He saw a sign that read PTA meeting in cafeteria and led his father in that direction. As they walked, he told himself to look on the bright side, just as Arjun was always telling him. His mother used to say the same thing. The bright side was that he would get to show his father where he stood in line for chocolate milk and footlong hot dogs. The bright side was that he would get to show him where he ate lunch with Sharon Nagorski. To Siddharth's surprise, the positive thinking did the trick, loosening him up. The cafeteria had dizzyingly tall ceilings and 20 tables with attached orange benches. One of its walls contained a glass case displaying student artwork and class pictures. Another wall was made almost entirely of windows. It looked out onto a blue Luciani Carding garbage dumpster and two flagpoles, one for the blue state flag and the other for Old Glory. Molnar dashed in front of him and headed to the back of the room, near the spot where you cleared your lunch tray. A little stand had been set up there with two coffee urns and a tray full of pastries. He made himself a cup with cream and sugar, then picked up a glazed donut. "Eat something," he said. "We'll have dinner late tonight." "I had a big lunch," said Siddharth. He was waiting for his father to ask him a question about school, about where his classroom was or which was his lunch table. As soon as his father asked him a question, he would tell him everything. Molnar chose an empty table, far away from the other people, from the wooden podium that had been set up on the other side of the room. Siddharth scanned the cafeteria. He felt stupid when he didn't see any other students. Thankfully, his teacher, Miss Kleinberg, was also missing. He spotted Mr. Grillo, the mustache school principal. He was wearing a three-piece suit, as usual. Larry, the old janitor, was hunched over a broom and chewing on one of his fat cigars. He always had a cigar in his mouth, but never actually lit them. All the other parents were chatting. They seemed to know each other, and they seemed to be having fun. Siddharth wished his father knew how to make small talk with the other parents. Most of them were women, but there were a few men dressed in jeans and sweatshirts. Molnar had on a cardigan sweater over a ribbed turtleneck. He looked like a dinosaur compared to these other guys. Mohanlal tapped him on the shoulder. What? Said Siddharth. His voice was harsh, but he was actually relieved. It was happening. His father was finally asking him about school. Where is that woman? Asked Mohanlal. Which woman? That shrink, that psychologist. You mean Miss Farber? Why would Miss Farber be here, Dad? This is for parents. Parents and teachers. Mohanlal shrugged. She should be here. She was the one who told me to come. You talked to Miss Farber? When did you talk to Miss Farber? A woman with black hair went up to the podium and said, Excuse me, everybody. I think it's time we get started. He poked his father in the arm. Dad, you talked to Miss Farber? When did you talk to Miss Farber? Mohanlal widened his eyes and put a finger to his lips. Siddharth shook his head and stared up at the pockmarks in the tiled ceiling. He felt like an asshole. He felt like his father had betrayed him. Welcome, everybody, said the black-haired woman at the podium. She was wearing a jean jacket. Her curly hair rose upward, not down. She tapped on the microphone, then started speaking. Most of you know me already. I'm Joe Antonelli, David's mom, and Joey's, and Ricky's, Mindy's too. Everyone let out a snicker, and Mohanlal laughed as well. Siddharth was glad. At least his father could laugh when he was supposed to. Mrs. Antonelli thanked John Ferrucci for the coffee and donuts. Let me tell you, she said, Ferrucci's is the only place in town where my mother would have bought her groceries. She asked everyone to hold off on refreshments until they adjourned, and Mohanlal took the remaining half of his donut in a single bite, using the collar of his turtleneck to wipe his mouth. Siddharth put a hand to his forehead and peered down. He hoped that no one had noticed his father scarfing his food. He hoped that nobody here knew about his visits to Miss Farber. He didn't mind visiting her in the retard room, as Luca Parati called it. He didn't mind as long as it was private. Mrs. Antonelli stared right in their direction. I'm pleased to see we have a newcomer tonight. Welcome. She flashed a wide smile. What's your name, sir? Siddharth swallowed. Greetings, ma'am, said Mohanlal. My son is a new student here. I'm Mr. Arora. We're so glad you could join us, she said. Ah, and I see you've brought your boy. Siddharth shrunk in his seat. Mrs. Antonelli thanked everyone for last week's baked ziti dinner, then provided the results of December's canned food drive. Everyone clapped, and a man in a checkered shirt and baseball cap stuck his fingers in his mouth and whistled. Siddharth recognized him. He was Eddie Benson's father. Siddharth turned to his own dad, who was sipping coffee and staring into space. Why did he bother coming if he wasn't even going to pay attention? Mrs. Antonelli cleared her throat. She said that with so many positive things going on, it was easy to ignore the harsher side of life. I'm sure you all know what I'm referring to. Our boys are making such big sacrifices out in the Persian Gulf. And here we are, living the good life in South Haven. I find myself sitting on the sofa, staring at the television, and wondering what I can do. How can I make a difference? Mohanlal leaned forward. Crap, thought Siddharth. Mrs. Antonelli said she wanted to make a motion to use $300 of PTA funds to buy each Deer Run student a yellow ribbon. The students could fasten these ribbons to their mailboxes in order to show support for Desert Storm. Mohanlal's eyes were now glued to the podium. Please don't, thought Siddharth. A woman with blonde bangs raised her hand. She said that Mrs. Antonelli always had such wonderful ideas. The man with the checkered shirt and baseball cap, Eddie Benson's father, was in agreement. We're all watching it from the couch, he said, but these kids, they're actually putting their lives on the line for our freedom. Heck, I wish we could do something more, something bigger. Siddharth noticed his father begin to smile. He nudged Mohanlal. He wanted to grab him and get out of there. A large woman with glasses stood up and said that the money could be better spent on an extra set of encyclopedias or color monitors for the computers. Mrs. Antonelli said, We're kind of short on time here, Lori. Let's table the encyclopedias until next time. It was then that Mohanlal raised his hand. Excuse me, Miss Joe? A vein in Siddharth's neck started pulsing. Mrs. Antonelli turned toward him. Her eyebrows curved like the wings of a seagull. Yes? I hope you don't mind, but I would like to add my 2 cents. Siddharth bit the inside of his cheek. Mrs. Antonelli flashed her fake wide smile. Absolutely! We would love it if you shared. Mohanlal handed his empty coffee cup to Siddharth, then stood up. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you don't mind, but I wanted to share a few small thoughts. He cleared his throat. You all seem like such intelligent people. This is why it is all the more urgent for us to really think this through. Before taking action, we must think this through and ask difficult questions. Mohanlal grinned as he spoke, which infuriated Siddharth. His father was always moping, always fighting off tears. His voice would even crack when he said goodnight. And now he was smiling. Now? Here? Mohanlal kept on going. Everyone here is an educated person, so you won't mind if I ask you a hard question. Is this war in the Gulf truly just? Is this a war we should be actually fighting? Because if we buy these ribbons, we are making a statement about this war. Siddharth dug his fingers into the back of his father's brown trousers. Mrs. Antonelli interrupted Mohanlal. Mr. Arora, right? Mr. Arora, I don't think I know what you mean. We are making a statement. Her voice was now sharper. Mohanlal continued smiling. It said, let's review our histories, ladies and gentlemen. Who gave Saddam his weapons? Who gave him his money? We did. We did these things because it served our interests. Folks, I am a firm believer in the use of force. But if we support this war, what message are we sending to the world? What message are we sending our children? The room was totally silent for a moment, one of the longest moments in Siddharth's life. But soon other parents started whispering. Soon people were scowling and yelling, and a chaotic uproar swept over the cafeteria. Siddharth tapped his forehead against the table. When he looked up, his father's eyes were gleaming in a way they hadn't for months. Mrs. Antonelli banged a gavel. Eddie Benson's father stood up. He walked to the podium and pointed at Mohanlal. With all due respect to him, Mr. Whatever his name is, everything that guy said, it's totally baloney. Mr. Benson turned toward Mrs. Antonelli. Part of my French, but that's a bunch of crap. The entire audience started clapping, except for the large woman with the glasses who had won the encyclopedias. Mr. Benson removed his baseball cap and patted down his hair. My cousin was in Nam, and when he got back, they spat all over him. That's not going to happen this time. Not on my watch. After some more applause, the blonde with the bangs made a motion to spend $600 on the ribbons, not $300. That way they could buy two for every student. Siddharth stood up and yanked his father's arm. Mohanlal shrugged him off. Let go of me, he said. He released his father and fled the cafeteria. He ran toward the car and wanted to keep on running. He wanted to run all the way home, but to his old home, the one where his mother had lived. For a moment, he wished it were his father who had gone. If he could, he would trade in his father for his mother. But he immediately regretted this line of thinking. He told himself that if his father were to die now, it would all be his fault. Thank you very much.
You have all gone from someone who was maybe thinking about writing a novel and maybe even talking about writing a novel to not only writing a novel, but seeing it published. And I was wondering if each of you could talk to us a little bit about the journey from idea to manuscript. How did that happen? All of them. Okay.
I could start. I wanted to write since I was 20. I dropped out of art school with the intention of writing. I realized that's really what I wanted to do. And I moved back to Boston. I signed up for my first writing workshop. And my father died suddenly. And my life just took on this other course. And I thought about writing for 15 years, which I don't recommend. but the longer that I thought about it and didn't do it, the bigger it became. The harder it became and the more terrifying somehow it became, which is something I'm just kind of really interested in general, how we can kind of do that to ourselves and make things bigger. But very short version of the story is that when I was 38, I was heading towards 40, and my beloved dog had died, and my brother was sick, and I'd spent all this time taking care of my dog, who had bone cancer, and I had spent all this money taking care of him, and it just kind of wiped out all of my excuses. I had been telling myself for years that I didn't, that I wasn't able to write because of no resources or no time. So I promised myself that when he went, that I would start writing, and I did, and that's when I did. So it was like a really long process to before I even just got started.
Well, I'll talk about the idea.
Yeah.
I started writing basically pages, and then, you know, I got up to a short story when I was so proud of myself that I could actually write a short story. And then people would say, why don't you write a novel? And I always felt like a novel, I had to have this big idea. I had to have a big idea that only could fit in a novel and only could... And also a structure in my head, and I never had it. So I just kept writing short stories, and one time I was going away to a writer's colony, and I had a whole month there, and I thought, what am I going to work on? And a friend of mine said, well, why don't you take something and see if you could make it a novel? And I thought, no, you have to have this idea. You have to have novel, like, you know, capital letters in your head. So I just started, and I wrote this two pages at a time. I mean, when I got to the end, I saw, oh, you're going to have to revise this now. You need to have some structure and everything. But it really was. I did it like, I don't know who it was who said, you know, you just, it's like seeing, you know, what you can see in front of you with the headlights on your car. That was kind of as much as I could see at any time.
You know, for me, I've been working with words and occasionally getting paid for it since I graduated from college. So it's been about 15 years, and there's been other books that I've been trying to write, and they just are in drawers or not, they don't exist anymore. I had a similar experience in the sense that I kind of fell into this novel while working on a short story about two of my characters who were adults in the short story, and I wrote a line about them that their parents had had an affair and they had slept together, and I thought that if I were to really understand the implications of that line on those adult characters, I should write around the backstory in my journal for a little while, and you know, so I wrote about these adults as children. You saw one of them in the passage from which I read, and then a page became 10 pages, became 100 pages, became 300 pages, and I said to my wife, I said, you know, I can't get out of this flashback, and I can't. And she was like, "This is your book, now. You know. And this is actually better. You know, I hated to tell you, but the stuff you were working on was kind of tired and trite. This feels a little bit better. But getting it out was just arduous, such a struggle. I mean, every cliche about, you know, just when you think you're done, you're not done, and you know, it just ended up being true. I didn't think I had enough in me to actually get this out into the world. And getting it out has been good, but it's funny, you know, you as a writer, you just hope and dream about the kind of publication process and getting out there, and it's obviously gratifying. It's so wonderful to be in a room full of readers, and at the same time, this part has been kind of challenging for me because it kind of brings out like some of my worst qualities, like narcissism and insecurity. and these are the things, like, as a human, I want to work away from, right? Like, not indulge, not fan the flames of them. But it's also made me realize that, like, I like writing. Writing is the best part of the writing process. Yes. And I can't wait to get back to it. So it's also made me feel confident I can keep on doing this because I like that better than waiting for a review to come out or getting my publisher's approval and such things.
It's such a weird experience because you go, especially your first time, you go from purely being an artist to suddenly being a business person. And you have to take this weird shift in thinking about your book. I think from probably the moment of agenting, it becomes very much about marketplace and about the sale. And so then you go through this like couple year really process of thinking your book as like a commodity. And it's kind of painful. I found that painful to make that switch. I'm so excited to be writing again after a year of Googling myself a lot. And then feeling really scared.
I'm going to throw out another question, but I want to encourage people, if they have questions, now would be a good time to approach the microphones and so that we can be mindful of our time. But one of the things that your novels had in common to me was a certain amount of attention to detail where setting was concerned. Mm-hmm. I thought that I appreciated the way you each oriented the reader in the specific space in which the story takes place. And I wanted to know, did that attention to detail as far as setting, did that emerge organically, or is that in the revision process, and you look at your draft and say, I need to place this more specifically? How did that emerge in each of your experiences? It's something that all three novels had in common.
Well, I can do that.
Okay.
I mean, for me, the novel, it started, like, Cambridge was almost a character in the novel. So
Right from
the very beginning, it started being about Cambridge. And I was inspired by, I was living in Cambridge and I was watching it change around me. So it was kind of, it started as that rant about what was happening all around in the neighborhood. And I'd also been born there, so I had sort of a lifetime of opinions that I could throw out suddenly.
So you're basing it on a real geographical space, and Hirsch, yours is a made-up space, right?
Mine's a made-up space that draws on very real places.
Okay.
That, you know, I think my book has felt very familiar to people who live in the greater New Haven area.
Okay.
But I noticed that as well, about as I heard everyone read about the importance of place. And like Jabari, I teach creative writing, and you know, I spend several weeks every semester just talking about inculcating a sense of place in narrative in order to just in order to infuse kind of authority into narratives. And from Louis's piece, I just was, just as the teacher in me was like, authority, you know, like, and in order to infuse plausibility into our narratives. But I like to think about place, and I think we learn a lot about human relationships by understanding the places in which they're set. We learn a lot about politics and historical transformations that are so important in understanding character by focusing on place. And I read widely, but I really learned about writing about place from crime writers. Boston's celebrated crime writer, Dennis Lehane. You know, if you want to learn about writing place, study Dennis Lehane or George Pelicanos. I mean, crime writers really get the importance of setting and context, and that's something that is very important to me.
For me, my book has been described as Vermont porn. The place was almost one of the first things. For me, it was very much one of the little sparks of the story. Came from a very, like, a lifelong, like, fantasy, and also just question about whether I could move to Vermont. I'm very much a city person. I grew up in Boston area, never lived farther than 10 miles away from the city. And so, like I said, like, one of my dearest friends lives in the Northeast Kingdom, and I would always go up there, and I'm so in love with it, and I just feel this very deep connection. But the idea of, like, living a country life is both very much a fantasy and very much, I just don't know if I would actually be happy. And so I'm very, one of my main goals in writing this novel is I really wanted to create a town. I love, I'm just really drawn to stories like in movies and television pieces that are ensemble pieces where you really feel like the whole town functioning. And so when I'm writing a scene that's taking place in the inn, I'm still like weirdly like picturing like who's at the grocery store right now and who's doing this. And, so that was really, really fun for me to create a whole town. And what's the other thing I wanted to say? But it's I very purposely created a fictional town because I knew it's very much a Vermont fantasy, and I'm very familiar with the reality of what it's like to live in the Northeast Kingdom. So I set out to make my own little fantasy world.
Started sort of creating a world.
Yeah.
Okay, I get it. You have a question? All right. Emerson in the house.
Yes. Thanks so much, first of all, for coming and reading today. I'm from Vermont. So Vermont porn, all about it. But I wanted to ask, and you mentioned on it, Louise, like what the process for each of you was like from, like, with your publishers from pitch to publication day, and what that was like.
Pitch to publication. I have such a funny story of how I sold my book. I had written maybe 25 pages or 30 pages of the novel, and I was really naive, and I signed up for my first Muse in the Marketplace conference and here in Boston, and you can pay an extra like $100 and you can meet with an agent or an editor. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. And so I did it, not really knowing that I was very early in the process and shouldn't be doing that. So I met with an editor, and she liked it. I was really surprised. And she said, keep in touch. And so it took me 3 years to write my first draft. And by then, I kind of figured out who she was and that I never should have talked to her. And so every 6 months, I would email her because I knew it was like going to be like, oh, I would never forgive myself if I blew this chance. So I was reading everything on her list. So I'd be like, oh, I loved this book and still not done. We'll let you know. And I wouldn't hear back from her. But every 6 months, I emailed her. And a complete act of kismet, she bought a book. It was Read Jane by Patty Park. Okay. And Patty had done the novel incubator program a year before me. And of course, when I got into the program, I was like, I have news. So I immediately emailed her and I was like, I'm in this program. I should be done with my draft by X time. And so when she bought Patty's book, I think it was just a little like, oh, what, you know, how do I know that program? Oh, you know, so she wrote me and asked to see it when it was done. And even then, I didn't ever think that she would actually buy it. So I didn't tell when I was agenting, I never told anyone about I have this relationship with an editor. But at the end, we went out and we gave it to her as an exclusive and she bought it. So it was really, wow. So I'm always like telling people, like, my only advice is just go and be nice and keep writing those like really embarrassing emails because you never know.
I had a very different experience. not nearly as fortuitous so far. I'm actually a little bit wary, and potentially the word cynical comes to mind when it comes to the state of publishing in certain ways. So on one hand, there are many opportunities for writers in a way that there weren't 40 or 50 years ago as a result of the corporatization of the publishing industry. And yet, all this consolidation, that large, gigantic corporations that have shareholders to which they kind of have a fiscal responsibility has meant that there might be a certain, in some realms, like just things become more monochromatic in terms of what agents and publishers are looking for. So I had this manuscript, and because of kind of where I've written for prestigious publications, things like that, people were always willing to read my work. Mm. But they wanted, and a lot of sometimes notable agents wanted to work with me if I were willing to make some big changes to my work, which I just couldn't do.
What's an example of one of those big changes?
Well, a great example is like make a book up with a child protagonist, a YA book, which I would have no problem with if I were a YA author. Mm-hmm. But selling a book with a child protagonist for adults in the 21st century proved very difficult. Mm-hmm. That would be a prime example of it. And it was tough, you know, because you want to get your work out there, but you want it to remain faithful to your vision. And that resulted in a very long quest for an agent that was fruitless for me. Mm-hmm. And I ended up eventually signing the book with one of the greatest independent publishers in the world, Akashic Books. And they're like family to me. They're very visible. That means that there's less economic resources behind the book, but a lot of personal energy. It's in a lot of bookstores. I get to be in places like here, but I have a day job still. So it's a tough balance. And I it's important. I think it's important to like look at authors who you admire and follow their careers a little bit.
I have a totally different story than either of you two, which is when I finished a draft of the novel, I went right to the Muse in the Marketplace and signed up to meet with an agent. Okay. So I did the exact same thing, and I met.
But you had a complete draft.
I had a complete draft. Okay. Yes.
And so should do it.
I had a complete draft, and I met with her, and she was like, oh, "I love this. This is great, and I'm just so happy." And I was like, I'm in heaven. I can't believe how easy this has been. Yeah. I finish it and, you know, boom, it happens. So I did the same thing. I kept in touch with her. And, you know, she started, like, sending me signals I should have taken. Like, you know, I'd ask for her email address or something, and she'd say, use this, and it would be general submissions. You know, she'd send me to, like, a box, you know. So, it, you know, over the course of a year, it finally, you know, became obvious that she was not going to do it. In the meantime, I sent it to another agent, and he said, oh, I really like it. Would you make some changes? I think you need to make these changes. And I read his changes, and I thought, they're great. This guy's so smart. Okay. And I did. So then I spent another year making his changes. And I sent my changes to him after a year, and he said, great, great. I'll never be able to sell it. So then I spent another year looking for an agent, found an agent who said, I really like this. Would you make us some more changes? And I was willing to make her changes, too, because she thought that my main character was really unattractive and a schlub. Mm. And I said, no, he's not. I was willing to make those changes. That's why I put in that he had been an athlete.
Right.
So I made those changes and sent them to her, and she said, I don't think I can sell this. It's just not sellable. And she said, but let's try.
Mm. Oh.
So she tried, and she couldn't sell it. Mm. So I went through that for 3 years.
Mm. Wow.
And, you know, it was so discouraging, and I was like, oh, my God, I thought I was going to be so lucky. So finally, she said, let's put this one aside. So, you know, we put it aside, and I started secretly sending it to contests.
Oh.
And I won a contest.
Oh.
So awesome. That's how it got published. I won a contest, a tiny press in L.A. called Gorski Press.
Mm.
And that's how I have a book.
Awesome.
So.
Awesome. Yeah. I'm hearing that more and more from friends.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. We've got 1 minute left. I wanted to get the last question really quickly.
Thank you. My question was about the drafting and revising process. If any of you could speak about how you knew when your draft was done, like ready to show people, ready to look for an agent, that step.
In 30 seconds or less.
Yeah.
I found my draft was done when I'd answered all my own questions. So I was ready for someone else's questions.
I felt my draft was done. I had this vision that there'd be this magical editor who was dying to help me make it better. And I thought, I've done all I can do. I need that editor to help me. That's when I felt I was done.
No, right. And you're never done. You know?
All right. All right. Another round of applause for our
Thank you.